Hello, you're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Kevin Young, poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine. On this program, we invite poets to choose a poem from the New Yorker archive to read and chat about. Then, we ask them to read one of their own poems that's been published in the magazine. My guest today is David Leman, the author of over a dozen books of poetry and prose, who's received awards and fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Ingram Merrill Foundation, and the Lila Wallace Reader Digest Fund. The founder and series editor of The Best American Poetry, he teaches in the graduate creative writing program at the New School. Welcome, David.
Nice to be here with you, Kevin.
The poem you've chosen to read is Worsening Situation by John Ashbery. Tell us, what in particular about this poem caught your eye as you're sifting through the archives?
Well, I remember it from the time it appeared in print, and it was also a poem that Ashbery particularly liked, as one could tell, because when he gave a poetry reading, he seldom read poems from his last volume. He preferred to read poems from his next volume or his work in progress. But the one poem that he would read from Self-Portrait in a Convex Mirror was Worsening Situation. I came to like the poem so much, I even wrote a poem of my own in the manner of this poem to try to convey why I liked it, because it's easier to do that in a way by paraphrase than by rational explanation, which I suppose is true for a lot of Ashbery's poems. One doesn't comprehend them in the ordinary sense since they jump all over the place and they move from one pronoun to another. They shift tenses. They change tone and subject matter. And this poem begins with two similes, but it is never indicated what the thing is likened to. So you as the reader may infer that the subject of the poem never stated is either the poet or poetry.
Well, let's give it a listen. Here's David Leman reading Worsening Situation by John Ashbery.
Worsening Situation. Like a rainstorm, he said, the braided colors wash over me and are no help. Or like one at a feast who eats not, for he cannot choose, from among the smoking dishes. This severed hand stands for life, and wander as it will, east or west, north or south, it is ever a stranger who walks beside me. Oh, seasons, booths, chaleur, dark-hatted charlatans on the outskirts of some rural fete, the name you drop and never say is mine, mine. Someday I'll claim to you how all used up I am because of you. But in the meantime, the ride continues. Everyone is along for the ride, it seems. Besides, what else is there? The annual games? True, there are occasions for white uniforms and a special language kept secret from the others. The limes are duly sliced. I know all this, but can't seem to keep it from affecting me every day, all day. I've tried recreation, reading until late at night, train rides, and romance. One day a man called while I was out and left this message. You got the whole thing wrong from start to finish. Luckily, there's still time to correct the situation, but you must act fast. See me at your earliest convenience, and please tell no one of this. Much besides your life depends on it. I thought nothing of it at the time. Lately, I've been looking at old-fashioned plaids, fingering starched white collars, wondering whether there's a way to get them really white again. My wife thinks I'm in Oslo. Oslo, France, that is.
That was Worsening Situation by John Ashbery, which was published in the January 20th, 1975 issue of the magazine. So I loved hearing you read that. I think you read it well and with this great emphasis. And I think also Is it me, or does the humor shine through when you hear it aloud? What do you think of that humor in this poem, and I suppose Ashbery's use of humor?
I believe Ashbery is a very funny poet, and though when he reads his poems, when he used to read his poems, it was with a very flat, non-affect, still the audience got the humor. For example, right. The last line, "I'm in Oslo, France, that is." That's very funny. It's hard to say what makes it so funny, but or the use of the commercial, the idea of starched white collars, wondering whether there's a way to get them really white again. His mind can move from Rambo, who's alluded to in this poem, and Keats. There's a phrase here, "this severed hand," at the end of line 4, I think is a deliberate echo of Keats's last poem, "This Living Hand." And as such, that would seem to be standing for poetry itself. But that in the same poem that you have Keats and Rambo, and I think there's also an allusion subtle to the Wasteland, you would also have a television commercial or a kind of plot device of a crank call warning you of something unnamed that will worsen your situation.
Or the annual games, or everyone is along for the ride, it seems, you know. I think that you're exactly right. I also think the poem has these interesting two parts on the page, the first part ending with reading late at night, train rides, and romance. And I think the poem is, in a way, that first part, which is allusion-heavy, has this kind of end-of-romance quality to it. And that crank call, as you put it, kind of intrudes on that, but also, I think, shows some kind of weird connection to that. The doom and gloom of this crank caller seems somehow kind of part of this romantic severed hand that is life. I wonder about that and how you take it, these two parts of the poem.
Well, now that you mention it, I can see your point also, because the end of the first stanza seems to me to recall the very end of the first stanza of part one of the Wasteland, where he says, I read late in the night and go to mountains. I can't quote it exactly, but I've tried recreation, reading until late at night, train rides and romance seems to bring back that voice. That is a despairing voice, although the things named, recreation, reading, rides, and romance, are as amusing as they are alliterative. It's interesting that the stanza break is only sort of half a break, because
right.
The second stanza begins indented after the end of the first stanza.
And it starts, "One day a man called while I was out."
Yes.
Well, and it shifts us sort of into a modern world, which we might have been in the whole time, but there's a way in which the first part of the poem has this old-fashioned quality, and then is the situation getting worse as the poem goes on, or is there a kind of redemption there, at least a rejection of this crank call or this bad news, which somewhat awaits us all? "Tell no one of this, much beside your life depends on it," ends the call. "I thought nothing of it at the time." There's something wonderful about that turn there. He could say anything, of course. He's gotten away with so much and brought us so far. But what do you make of that turn there?
I find it interesting that the word life, your life, and much besides your life depends on it, is the second time in the poem that very large noun is mentioned. The first time is "this severed hand stands for life."
Right, right.
I suppose that the worsening situation may be the writer's life itself.
Or the reader's life.
That's right. It could be anyone's. Everyone is along for the ride, which is the kind of cliche that he loves.
Right, right. Well, tell me a little bit, too, about you clearly had a long relationship and knowing him as a poet. Would you tell us just a little bit about your impressions of that, whether It's about the changes his work made or didn't make. How do you think back on this important American and world poet?
Well, he was my favorite poet. He still is my favorite poet. I felt that he was a genius from the time I met him. He had an extremely dry wit. He was a very funny man. He knew more about more things than anyone I think I've ever met. And his style was, in a way, inimitable, and yet at the same time, everyone was imitating it, or aspects of it. For example, his use of pronouns. You never knew whether the I, you, he, or she were all aspects of the same personality, which I think they are. I think he prized something he once called polyvocality, that is having a lot of different voices in your head and right, letting them all speak as if life were a drama. And as if poetry were something that was going on in his mind at all times, and he could just sit down and cut off a bolt of this cloth.
Yeah, that's well said. And I think that the high and low, as it were, of his mix, I think, is both influential and also shared, as I know you've written, with the New York School poets, of which Ashbery has long been considered one, and one of the key ones. Would you tell us just a little bit about how you see him fitting into the New York School and maybe sort of the extensions of that for our own time?
Yes. At Harvard in the late 1940s, Ashbery, Kenneth Koch, and Frank O'Hara were all students. Kenneth helped John get into the Harvard Advocate literary magazine, and there began a close friendship and competition between these two fellows. They were very loyal friends for the rest of their days. And in his last weeks at Harvard, John met Frank O'Hara at, I think, a record store. He overheard Frank make some outlandish remark to the effect that Poulenc was greater than Wagner. And they were instant friends. These three formed a core, and then James Schuyler became a fourth, when they all were living in New York City in the early 1950s, and they got along very well with painters. The painters were known as the New York School, like right, Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning, Franz Klein, Hans Hoffmann, and so on. And a gallery dealer thought that he would appropriate that term for the poets, as if this were
a
branch.
Is this Tibor Denage?
Yes. There was a man of great showmanship who was running the gallery then called John Bernard Myers, and he coined the phrase. Ashbery never liked it because he thought that he was more of an individual than part of a movement. They prized humor. They prized the spirit of parody. They also turned to other forms of art rather than just poetry. They looked for inspiration to music or painting.
Jazz, I think, is...
Jazz, too.
For us jazz heads, is very much a music that plays with high and low and with illusion and quickness and the kind of slipperiness of language. So even if it's not in reference, I feel like there's a kinship there. I think that plays itself out also in your poem that we're about to talk about. In the September 23rd, 1991 issue, The New Yorker published your poem, Stages on Life's Way, which you're going to read for us now. And I wonder if you could mention just a little bit about what the structure is. We can talk after about how you came to it.
Sure. I have the feeling, reading John's worsening situation, that he may have written it in one sitting and not revised it, although he may have and yet still accomplished that feeling that it all came out at once. Often that's true of my poems, but that's not the case with Stages on Life's Way. I had been working for a year on this poem and related poems that were composed of sonnets. This poem has three sonnets, and each has a part title. I was trying to write about romance and at the same time about something larger, like one's entire career. So I called the poem Stages on Life's Way because that's the title of a book by Kierkegaard. And I thought it would be somewhat ironic, but at the same time, I like the idea of implying that there were questions of faith as well as fate in my poem about romance.
Here's David Lieben reading his poem, Stages on Life's Way.
Stages on Life's Way. One, the night before. He liked waiting. Waiting gave him a purpose to live. Waiting outside the marriage counselor's office, he read that the unconscious is structured like a language. The verbs in the dream he had the night before were copulating on flying carpets or chasing taxis in Tokyo, always doing something, taking action, not just waiting as he was doing now, waiting quietly in an armchair holding a book, or pacing back and forth like an expectant husband, waiting for the appointment with the insignificant clerk without whose signature the elopement would be canceled, waiting without anxiety, knowing that the time of the wait would be infinite and how much clear thinking could be done, waiting for the dinner bell, for the music to begin, waiting for the fog to lift so the darkness could be seen. Two, the morning after. You're a bastard, she said, admiringly. He was. He admitted it. He saved his own book from the flames, letting hers burn. How young he looked. She spat. I'd rather be dead. The ritual began with a kiss, as it always did. The one-armed man identified himself. My name, he flashed his teeth, is Death. And the fruit in her mouth turned to ash in the darkened hotel room under the coverlet. A ringing phone interrupted their embrace. She put a hand to her face. Where had he seen her before? In somebody else's window. The woman in the painting was somebody else's widow, somebody else's wife. But that was art, and this was life. Three, the next day. He was impulsive. One day he decided to read Conrad and bought The Secret Agent, Victory, and Under Western Eyes. The next day he had a craving for canned fruits and came home with purple plums in heavy syrup, Queen Anne cherries in light syrup, and pineapple chunks in juice, no sugar added. Also, he wasn't going to the theater enough, so he lined up seats for Gypsy and City of Angels. Then he forgot to go and left the cans of fruit in the icebox and put Conrad on the shelf. The next disaster hadn't yet begun, so there was time to find out what she was like as a child, and they could be children together in her parents' hotel room, opening the drawers, hiding in the closet, and she put on her mother's pearl necklace, and later they looked for snakes behind bushes, and she fell down. It was summer, a bowl of ripe apricots, the mud on their knees.
That was Stages on Life's Way by David Lieben.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
I loved hearing you read that. That was so great. I feel like in the poem, we progress through this end of a romance in a way.
I think the idea of writing the next disaster after, to open a line, just a few lines after writing the next day, implies that you're going from one crisis to another, either in the marriage or in one's life. I did like the idea of ending with a certain kind of hope concealed in memory. There was time. Ending the line there, there is still time to do a lot of things, of which one would be to go back to being as innocent as a child and remembering the days prior to puberty when one played with, when a boy might play with a girl and she put on her mother's pearl necklace wanting to be an adult, so that these kids are acting out their adult fantasies. That seemed like a hopeful way of concluding.
I love that line, too. The end stanza, I should say. The woman in the painting was somebody else's widow, which is also playing with window from the previous line. Somebody else's wife. But that was art, and this was life. And that distinction or that dismissal of the kind of fantasy that the speaker, but also I think implied we all engage in, is interesting. How's that work for you now, or how do you think it? You pictured it working then?
I was very happy when I got to that stanza and could allow window to shade into widow and then wife, implying adultery, but also a fresh romance, but then leaving it unclear whether we were talking about something like a novel or life itself, which is left out. But that was art, and this was life. What does that refer to? What does this refer to? I think, in a way, that's something that I derived from Ashbery, the idea that a pronoun could make perfect sense in context and yet leave it wide open as to what it specifically represents.
We've been talking, in a way, about romance, big R and little r romance, and I wonder how much of the romantics you think play into your work, but also in this continuum you're talking about with Ashbery.
Well, my favorite group of poets in the history of English poetry are the Romantic poets, particularly Coleridge, Keats, Byron, Wordsworth, Shelley. I do think Ashbery is a Romantic poet in that tradition, a late Romantic, a tradition that also includes Emerson and Whitman and, I guess, Wallace Stevens. I feel that the Romantics exalted imagination over all else. And I believe that that's something true of the New York School and something true of a lot of us who find reality unsatisfactory in many ways and therefore resort to art as a way of escaping from actuality by creating something worthy of our respect, if not adoration.
I wonder, I'm aware that the romantic lineage we're talking about, it sounds a little like a boys' club. Do you feel like that's true? Is this idea of imagination gendered in any way? Or how does Emily Dickinson, for instance, what does she tell us, being to me the great poet, one of our great poets of all time, but also certainly of the 19th century? Is she romantic? Is she anti-romantic? How does she tell us about ourselves?
Oh, I think she's a key figure. She's also one of my favorite all-time poets, and along with Whitman, I think the grandmother of American poetry, if he's the grandfather. They're an odd couple, for sure. But she's, you know, she writes about how there's no frigate like a book for escape. She writes about death as if she's already had the experience of it, which yes, is a great claim for the imagination to make. I find her a central figure and someone I turn to more and more. And I love teaching her because, you know, if you recite a first line of one of her poems and dare the, not dare, but challenge the group to come up with a good second line that would follow, they will never be able to match the surprise that she has in store for us with line two.
Right. Well, I think surprise is key. I think it's definitely part of a romantic wish for a poem to be inspired, to be an example of genius and of saying something new. All ideas I think we carry with us when we read a poem. I think romantic ideals are very much ones we have, but also of the sort of soul genius receiving this message, often not from within, but from without, that is about nature or the world or transcendence in some way. I wonder how that, thinking again of your poem, which thinks about romance in a particular way, I wonder how we handle it, because I love how you bring us right into the marriage counselor office, or you bring us into this argument in the second part of the poem. But then also this kind of, is it lazy? Is it a kind of a self that isn't so genius-y maybe, that is buying these canned goods and can't really crack Conrad? Is that a lessening? Is that just a fact-based version of modern life, or a fiction-based version of modern life, if you will? How do we square these moments in time?
Well, I agree with you about surprise. Wasn't it Emerson who said, "What we mount to paradise on the stairway of surprise"? And the wish to surprise the reader is certainly something central in poets like Ashbery and O'Hara. And it's something I value a great deal. I think that as a poet, you have very little opportunity to catch the reader's attention, especially in a day of shrinking attention spans. You've got to grab the reader in the first line and keep surprising that reader. And in the case of this poem, once I got to the line, "But that was art and this was life," I felt that I had to move from the world of art to a much more quotidian actuality. This is life. Life is, buying these books and buying these cans of fruit, which I think it's somewhat humorous to describe with, the cans of purple plums with heavy syrup and Queen Anne cherries and light syrup and so on. That all seems like deliberately anticlimactic. But it seemed to me like, in a way, part of life itself, that one does these things and then forgets about it.
Right, right. And, there's almost a kind of triumph when you make it home with those cans, or when you buy that Conrad, or he wasn't going to the theater enough, so he lined up seats, then he forgot to go. And that, too, is, I think, part of modern life, and I think you capture it so beautifully here.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, David. It's really a pleasure talking with you. Stages on Life's Way by David Leman, as well as John Ashbery's poem Worsening Situation, can be found on newyorker.com. John Ashbery's latest book is his collected poems, 1991 to 2000. David Leman's most recent collection is Poems in the Manner of. Thanks again, David.
Thank you, Kevin.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on newyorker.com and on the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Pintigree Ferryman from the album The Highlander's Farewell by Alastair Fraser and Natalie Haas from Colburnie Records. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Eisenman.